Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Man Team.
QNL.
Star Trek reference into the show.
Yay.
I know, Lisa, you don't fall into the middle part of the Venn diagram, but there is that overlap that we must acknowledge. We must give the listeners what they want.
Right. I'm sure they were really looking for that.
I guess, which also means now that Mackie and Lisa need to finish the show by themselves, and
the rest
of us will leave.
She probably wants a Star Trek, too.
No, see, listeners would rather listen to women talk about Civ than guys talk about Civ. It's well known. It's a well known fact.
I see. I understand now. You decided to talk.
A composite show, archive segments from previous episodes that got cut due to time.
Well, most nukes ever launched the game. Yeah, I think we already had that.
I think Phil alluded to that, actually, in one of the segments that was actually included in episode 84. I think Phil was lamenting not quite getting to 200.
No, that was just in one game. I've gone over 200 before. It was just the one that I was streaming on that I didn't quite get to 200.
I think we should qualify this with the most nukes in a game without World Builder.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I think back in Civ 3, I built like 50, but that was a long time ago. I don't get that point in the game, and the only thing I like is clicking the red button because it just looks so epic. But other than that, I don't really like nuking things.
You can kill an awful lot of units for a good hammer conversion. An awful lot. I mentioned this, I believe, as a guest on Polycast, that you can gift tactical nukes to the AI when it's at war, and it will launch them immediately on its war target. But also a very good use that I've learned to use a little bit more consistently since then is launching tacticals from submarines and then going in and capturing coastal cities. If you do that with paratroopers, you can wipe out an entire civ in one turn on most maps because you can just capture the city, just walk into the city untouched, move your submarine with nukes in there, launch nukes on the interior cities, paratroop and capture those too. Unless they have corporate executives because the game is stupid that way and a corporate exec will block you. But anyway, you can capture almost every coastal city on turn one or every coastal city they have on turn one, completely wipe out their navy, completely wipe out any stack they have interior that could cause you trouble, and basically the AI screwed then. Even if it was the strongest force in the world, the turn you declared, it's all gone, instantly.
How does a corporate executive block you? Does he offer you a huge suitcase of money or something?
I know, I'm just still laughing at that.
Well, it's related to the paratroopers not being able to attack after paradropping. They can just walk into an undefended city that has nothing in it. So even something like a worker could block you. Although the AI generally doesn't keep those in the city until, like, its last city.
The most I ever built was about a dozen, and that was in a multiplayer pile-up on the AI.
Yes, I remember that one. I had over 100 that game, actually. They're all tacticals, but they count just the same if you launch them. We learned a valuable lesson that two-move units don't move through Fallout very well. Specifically, Mackie did.
Yeah.
Haven't you captured Berlin yet? No. Especially because that city guy must have gotten nuked like 10 times since it was the last one left.
And it's like, capitulate, we're doing fight on our own.
You gotta love when the AI does that.
Yeah, with your corporate execs defending your cities.
Oh, not coins in my eye.
Finally, throwing money does something.
Throwing money at a problem does solve it.
Let's talk about tech building, because I'm not very good at that.
I don't even know if I give myself a passing grade. If so, just barely.
Yeah. The thing that I have trouble with is that I always forget which bulbs I'll get based on which technologies I've already researched.
There's a thread, Dave MCW here, if you look for a post started by him. It's called Great People Tech Preferences. It shows the priorities for every great person in the game.
Now, for bulbing, the only great person that's really viable is great scientists. They have a much higher base value for bulbs than other great people, and the amount of population in your empire is also affecting that, and it helps them more than it helps other great people. So if you want to go with the bulb strategy, usually scientists are the way to go. The most typical tech lines to bulb down are philosophy, paper, education, liberalism, or if you avoid meditation, you can avoid bulbing philosophy, and if you avoid civil service or theology, you can avoid paper, and then you'll bulb down the astronomy line and get to astronomy quickly. And then after that, you have options for printing press, chemistry, scientific method, and physics after that for a scientist.
See, let's just rewind for a second there, because that's one of the weirdest little hidden things in the entire game. You can bulb down the education line or the astronomy line, and it entirely depends on whether or not you teched meditation right back at the start of the game.
Okay, that's sort of true, sort of isn't. Meditation is a prerequisite for philosophy. If you have Code of Laws or drama, you will bulb philosophy then, as opposed to bulbing, say, optics or astronomy. But if you don't mind that, and you want to use the religion you get from philosophy for pacifism to get more great people, you can take meditation and then just bulb philosophy. Use an extra great person. You'll get astronomy slightly later, but it could be useful.
That's great against AIs, because philosophy is good for trading.
Yes, but what you can't do if you want to bulb astronomy, you cannot tech civil service or theology, because if you do that, then you will bulb paper, and then you'll go education down that path instead.
You know, the difference is, are you playing against AIs, trading with AIs, or playing against people? And really, if you're playing against people, you want to go down the astronomy path because you're going to need your ships. If you're trading with the AI, trading with them, then you want to go down the philosophy liberalism path so that you can trade and get good techs.
Bulbing is a lot stronger if you can trade. I would not advocate it generally if you can't, because you don't get the multiple tech trade values for an individual bulb. Especially if you're playing against people and you're not tech trading at all, it's just all positioning your empire for war. You might get more out of bulbing if it gets you to something quickly. Astronomy is an excellent example on like an islands map or water map, because if you get that first and no one else has it, you're in an excellent position. Getting education sooner depends. If you're in war trouble, you're not going to be able to invest in the infrastructure for universities in Oxford very early regardless. So that's more of a judgment call. But against the AI, it can be very strong. I'm pretty familiar with it, and even so, I just can't match what Unconquered Sun did in Beyond the Sword of the Month 10, where he got communism in like 800 AD, mostly through bulbing. It's just incredible, the potential for it.
There's a technique to getting a heap of great people during a golden age.
Basically, you get a 100% multiplier just for being in a golden age. And if you have a religion, you can slip over into pacifism as well, and caste system preferably, so you can run as many scientists as a city can possibly have. Like, you have infinite slots. So what you do if you want to get them quickly during the golden age is you run scientists into starvation. Cities can't lose more than one population per turn. So at first, it's a bit of a judgment just while you're starving down initially how many scientists you want to run. But then once you start starving, don't work any tiles at all. Just work nothing but scientists. And you'll starve, you know, one pop a turn, but you'll get a tremendous amount of great person points doing that. And the returns for doing that can be worth the starvation of an individual city, or even possibly two individual cities, if you don't have a good national epic site set up yet.
Yes, it's a crazy move, and then once the Golden Age is done, you stop starving everybody.
Or even switch out of civics.
This is actually something that I've kind of recently started to appreciate more, is that starving people is a really good strategy. If you've got a city that doesn't have much production, but has tiles that it could get production from, I have always tended to be scared of starving them just to get production. But not anymore. I'll happily let the city starve just so that that city can work hammer tiles, so that I can push out units faster. And the city sort of naturally realigns itself into that new role after it's shed its population.
Yeah.
And there seems to be absolutely no other negative to it beyond the fact that you've changed the specialization of the city.
The only negative is if you could get better production on average by whipping rather than doing that, but that depends on the city. Usually cities over a certain size. Well, if it's oversized 10, it's definitely not a good idea to be whipping anymore.
And the whipping will cause you too much unhappiness. That's the other problem. Starving won't cause you the same unhappiness.
There's ways around that, though, by making sure you do a multiple pop whip and allow yourself to recover so you don't stack it too much.
And have the globe theater, perhaps.
Well, then you're going to whip as much as possible in later draft. But that's a very specialized city.
Yes, for our listeners, no unhappiness in the city if you have global theater.
We're starving to death, but we're happy.
Yeah, so you can abuse the crap out of them. You can do whatever you want to them, and they stay happy.
Put as much food as possible in that city, and you can draft out of it every single turn until you get past rifles.
If you're playing on a lower level, like Noble, that bulbing really isn't worth it. You're much better off planting the scientists.
Usually, or in academies, in your better research cities. The exception is if you want to get to astronomy early on, like a Terra math, or you just want to be able to invade and finish the game sooner. I can picture that happening on Noble. You already sweeped your continent, and the only way you can kill more people is astronomy. So you want to get there sooner. Plus, you get the good trade routes from that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Early Lumber Mills unbalanced game? Asks Thomas. I'm not asking how to change how lumber mills are made available with an earlier technology. It's simple to do. But I'm not sure if it would break my game. Are lumber mills so much better than mines or other stuff you could build over the forests? Of course, lumber mill plus one hammer plus one additional hammer with railroad plus one commerce with next to a river requires replaceable parts. And I believe the general consensus is, and I will agree with it, that it would not unbalance the game if the lumber mills were available earlier, and I might actually build them more often rather than on those tiles later on in the game, particularly in Tundra, for example, where the city could actually have some kind of longer-term usage if I actually put lumber mills on them. But other than that situation, they very rarely make an appearance in my cities.
Could I just take a step back on this one for a second and say the idea of a 4000 BC civilization deforesting an entire continent is just ridiculous. You know, it took the Middle Ages to deforest the majority of Europe, and even then they just started spreading out to the colonies, right? And they still hadn't run out of trees then. They were just scared that they were going to run out of trees. So chopping down trees and losing the trees out of an entire square is stupid. So, yes, I support lumber mills too, because that's more realistic. You're getting hammers out of working the trees and chopping them down. And what's really wrong here is replanting the forests. That's a newer tech. But chopping down an entire forest is not something that easy to do. So I don't like the mechanic of chopping down trees. It's a super overpowered technique as well.
It really is. And the incentive to do it goes beyond that even, because it provides attackers defensive bonuses in your territory. So even if you would be slightly better off leaving them,
yes,
you'll sometimes chop them anyway, because they're a liability. The health is nice, but there's a lot of incentive to chop, definitely. And having lumber mills a little bit earlier would help with that. I don't know if machinery would be better or which tech would make it balanced, but clearly replaceable parts is too far into the game, for ancient Aerostars anyway, for them to be really viable on most tiles. And that's a shame, because usually if there's an option in the game, it should be something that you can actually make use of once in a while at least. And that's pretty rare for lumber mills. And you can't replant forests at all, which is kind of annoying. You can do the forest preserve thing, and that makes it 8 times more likely to spread, but 8 times of a fraction of a percent isn't that much.
That's not likely something you even want half the time, because you've got cottages there that have turned into towns. You're not going to remove the cottage just to regrow trees.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
You're right, Michael. They ought to regrow once a century if you don't do anything else with the land.
Yeah.
Well, it just seems like the squares represent a large enough area that a full deforestation prior to the Middle Ages just seems impossible, especially across your entire continent, which is what happens, right? You know, by the Middle Ages, you've deforested everything. The only real example of it happening prior to medieval times is the like Maui statues in Easter Island. They were an island. Of course they're going to run out of resources. So I flipped this on this head that the whole lumber mills early on is actually the answer. The answer should be to fix forest chopping. I don't know how you'd fix it, but that's my take on it.
I forget who it was, but there was someone who actually, along those lines, was saying that, no, not only do I think it doesn't unbalance the game, but I in fact think it would balance the game even more. You've taken it a step further than that.
I agree with that. Having lumber mills earlier would be better for game balance.
Yes, because we did actually have lumber mills before replaceable parts.
Yes.
Yeah. That machinery would be good.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, but the thing is, lumber mills do not a replanted forest make. That's the thing here, is that lumber mills give you hammers from a forest and the forest doesn't disappear. It's just not reality. That makes no sense to me.
Well, it depends on the rate you're cutting trees versus planting them. It's not like it's an advanced concept that if you chop down all the trees at once, you're going to run out.
Right, but when we started clear felling with machinery, and that is a machinery tech, right?
Okay.
That's when we started truly removing forests in their entirety. Prior to that, you really shouldn't be able to remove a forest from the map, barring a fire.
Mm.
A giant fire.
That's true that it would be a problem in Civ 4, though, because you often have heavily forested starts, and you need to clear it to be able to work anything.
Well, that was a Beyond the Sword change, too, remember? A hack in the map generation code that puts more forests around you, just so you can chop them.
Well, sure, but sometimes you just have heavily forested land in general, and if you can't clear it, you're kind of an SOL, because you can't put any improvements on it for such a long time.
Yeah. Why can't you add a farm onto land that has forest? It's not jungle, right? That's the difference. It's forest.
Yes.
In early America, what they did is they gird the trees, strip them or cut into the outer wood to kill the tree, and then they plant corn and hills in between. You'd have to hoe it and grub out the roots, but if you let the trees there, it would shade the crop. You know, and then that killed the forest. And then...
But there's no hammers in that. That's just dead forest for no gain.
No, that was wasteful.
That's right.
That was wasteful, but that was just saying that they ought to be able to convert the forest into farmland.
Without the hammers.
Yeah, okay. I agree with that.
And then after it dried out, then they could burn it off.
Yeah.
And in fact, you could almost go a step further and say if they don't develop irrigation, you can dust bowl the whole place for them.
I actually don't see a problem with 4000 BC civilization decimating a forest. That's slash and burn farming, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but for hammers?
Yeah, but no, they wouldn't get hammers for it.
You don't get that many hammers early on.
Hammers? Anyway. You can turn forests into people, man.
Lord of the Rings stuff.
Your Civ 4 identity, posted by some guy or gal. Great, I'll fix that in a minute. I don't know if this has been done before, but what is your Civ 4 identity? From favorite leader, favorite Civ, favorite AI, and least favorite strengths, weaknesses, favorite and least favorite Diplo music, and favorite era. In answering this question, I eliminated the Diplo music just because it's been a long time since I've listened to the Diplomacy music. I've got my own soundtrack that I listen to. But other than that, favorite leader, and I'm inferring favorite leader is a favorite leader to play. It's definitely changed over time. As much as I would love to attach it to financial, I told myself I was going to move away from him. So I'm going to go with Peter as expansive and philosophical. Favorite Civ to play. Mongolia, favorite AI to having to deal with, Mansa Musa and Pakal, least favorite AI to have to deal with, Montezuma and Shaka, honorable mention to Toku, strengths, my own, classical era warfare, wide empires, ICS, and diplomacy trades, and weaknesses, city specialization, medieval era warfare, and those tall empires, and favorite era, classical. Why don't we go by order of seniority here for the next one, Phil?
Wow. Without Mackie here, that's just awkward. I actually posted mine in the thread, so I'll just read off from there. My favorite leader is Shaka, yes. And there's a reason why he's my rival in all my Pokemon Let's Plays. I love Shaka so much. Favorite Civ, America, because I like cherry tapping. For you listeners out there who don't know what cherry tapping is, it's not as bad as it sounds. No, cherry tapping is when you're deliberately using something bad to embarrass or humiliate your opponents, and just smacking the AI around with America and Civ just makes me smile. Favorite AI is Izzy for every reason you might think, and I'll just leave it at that. I consider my strengths in this game, diplomacy with the AI, my knowledge of the mechanics. I probably spent a little bit too much time on Civ Fanatics forums. And all warfare, but especially modern warfare, which I run a lot in the game, as well as just playing the game quickly and perhaps rambling on while doing so. My weaknesses are the random number generator, precision micro, and situations requiring excessive planning. I just don't have the attention span for it most of the time. Like, I could do it, but it's less fun for me to play that way. I like the Mongolian music, and I don't really have any Diplo music I dislike.
You kind of paraphrased some part of it, didn't you?
A little bit, a little bit.
Yeah, I noticed you brushed over the monologue one. In any event, Lisa?
Okay, so my favorite leader would probably just be Catherine. I don't know, I just have the habit of playing with her, and also she's the most decent-looking leader. And I like her traits, too. She's like, what was she again? Financial or something?
She's creative and materialistic.
Yeah, anyway, those are good. I like creative, financial, realistic, organized. I like charismatic too. I just don't like protective. I hate protective. My favorite AI to see is probably, Hattie. Hattie's really nice. And yeah, she just does wonders and gets really religious. And strength? I don't know. Cheesy culture win games. And weaknesses would be I haven't done a conquest and victory in a really long time. I don't know. I don't have the time to like take over all those or like the I guess precise planning ability like to get it all done or you know, making under or whatever. Yeah, sometimes I'm really, really bad at science. I need to improve that. I don't run enough scientists early enough. Favorite Diplo music is I don't know. I like Elizabeth's. Like early on, it's like this really tribal stuff, and then it turns into like classy stuff. Yeah, least favorite. Yeah, I don't like Ragnar. I hate Ragnar. Favorite era is probably industrial, and my least favorite era is I don't know. Maybe probably maybe way beginning. Yeah.
Actually, the opening poster didn't actually indicate what their least. Favorite era was, and if I had to choose one, the ones that I never get to, so.
If only because they run so slowly.
Gil, what about you?
What about me? Favorite leader? well, I'll go with my threat. I like the creative and spiritual, which means heavy. Yeah,
that wouldn't be why you use her eye as an icon or anything.
No, absolutely not. That's not my avatar.
Oh,
anyway,
yeah, certainly.
He's just trying to get in Lisa's good books.
Ooh.
Well, I've had that avatar for like forever. Anyway, favorite Civ. I like Egypt. Well,
four
like
chariots.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Best Russian for normal speed, by the way.
Favorite AI. Well, Mansamisa is always nice for trading. But always, any AI that tends to fall backwards is very nice. Tokugawa, for example, just so easy to pick his cities later on. Least favorite AI. Any of the crazies, I guess. Montezuma?
Yeah.
Strength. Well, I have a good knowledge of the game. I like whipping. So slavery is useful. And I do like to use a lot of, what's the name again? Well, that's slavery. I have blank. Too bad. Weaknesses. Well, definitely dagger attacks. It's pretty hard to get out of them. You have to watch your borders and see if you see any AI units incoming your way. And even then you're not sure it's an attack. I tend to play too fast at times. That's not good. Favorite Diplo music. It's gotta be Shaka. It's just, I love the music. On the other end, least favorite? I actually don't know. I think I like
all of
them. I think I like all of them. Favorite era? Renaissance, for sure. It has the best music and the best text, for a cavalry rush, for instance, which is the best. And least favorite era? Modern, lags too much.
Favorite leader, definitely Mehmed II. Expansive, organized. And likewise, the favorites are the Ottomans. That combination of those traits with their uniques, I mean, Janissaries, you can go on a nice big military push in end of medieval. And the Hammam, you can get cities, you know, I mean, that's two whole size points higher because that gives, +2 health, +2 happy.
In addition to getting extra health from expansive and extra cities, you just grow humongous cities, which are my my main strength is just growing just humongous cities. You know, a little bit of ICS, but more so just getting just big, big double-digit cities nice and early. My favorite AI is Isabella, because she is very much predictable, and she always makes the games very interesting. Least favorite AI is Mansa Musa, having a runaway lead on the other continent when I first meet him after getting astronomy. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm on my way to space victory. Hi. My weaknesses are prolonged wars on the offensive, or very short wars on the defensive, meaning the AI backstabs me and I'm not ready for it. Adding to that, specialist micro. I tend to cottage more just because I'm just really bad at microing specialists around. Favorite Diplo music, gotta be the Spanish. I put Japan as my least favorite Diplo music, but now I'm trying to remember which of the ones it was. It might have been Korea. But really, I don't really have a least favorite per se. Favorite era is definitely the classical. A lot of the best things you do on there can generally win you or lose you the game later on. And least favorite era, modern, for reasons stated above.
Discuss the moral combat liberals play computer games like conservatives, question mark. And would you like to introduce that topic?
Ouch. Do I have to?
I like that ouch.
Well, I read this article, and I don't know what to think about it, really. I mean, it must make some sense in the United States, but I don't see the point. I mean, she is this writer is telling about her experiences in playing Sims and World of Warcraft, I think, and Civilization. And she claims that she's a liberal in real life while she's playing her games like a conservative, which means she's always trying to do, I don't know, she sends her kids to school and, I don't know, she's a great mom and so on in Sims, or she always, I don't know, she always does a conquest victory in Civilization, she's never a peaceful type of player and so on. I mean, it doesn't make much sense even if you read the article. But it's an interesting thought. it's an interesting thought about the thing we talked about Dan and I through messages is that players' personality usually reflects on how they play their games, and I don't think that Civilization or Sims or any other game is either a liberal or a conservative game or I don't think they promote these two concepts. I think all the computer games are simply a simulation of how would things look like if you are the engineer, and you can be either a liberal in your as a person or a conservative as a person, and that personality will come out when you play the games, not necessarily the ones you are telling the world you are.
I don't know if even that's true. Because games are essentially like a fixed system with the rules where you're trying to optimize an outcome. But the purpose of all that is to have fun. So, you know, you might have some people who play their games as an escape from real life and just do things that are completely different from what they would do in real life because of that. And then you have people who essentially play in games like their real life personality is, and are, you know, they're just enjoying the challenges of the game itself. And it's hard to tell the difference between one player versus the other without knowing the player firsthand. But, the games themselves certainly don't promote one thing or the other. I mean, certainly you don't have to be a warhawk in any civilization game to be successful, just as an example. And I don't know how you get super conservative in The Sims or something.
I was going to say, because there's one character type you can get in The Sims that their measure of success is sleeping around the neighborhood. That's not conservative.
I can't say I have a lot of Sims experience, but that's kind of funny.
I think the biggest problem, it's not actually a problem, but I think that people who are not very comfortable in, who are not feeling comfortable in the games they play, that they are not going to experiment too much. And I was expecting from a person like this one, this writer, who is supposedly liberal, to be liberal. I mean, to experiment with stuff. Maybe she could start one game and have her child be a drug addict. Maybe in the second game she could have a child who is a fantastic musician. And in the third one she could, I don't know, she
not have her own children in at all. Because she could do that too.
So variations on the theme is, I think, what's really interesting about games. Not so much about what the game or the best mechanics or the easiest way to win is, really.
Listeners, I think the number one thing you can take away from the story is that you have no need for morals in video games. Right.
I was about to say, yeah, a little qualifier there at the end. Thanks.
Yeah.
In video games. Yes, we know you aspire to be an evil overlord, but come on.
I swear I wouldn't nuke the world in real life that way. I swear.
So you would have minions, you know. You would be there. No.
I should say my minions wouldn't nuke. I said I wouldn't nuke the world.
I won't personally hit the big red button, but I might tell a minion, push that button over there and not tell them what it does.
No, I would push the button. It's just that the button's function would be to instruct my minions to do something. You see, so we had to be very careful in our design.
Yeah, just to quote Monica Potts, who is the author of this article, the American Prospect Associate Editor, concludes her article by saying that, quote, maybe video games also tease out the latent conservative in all of us, quote unquote. Okay, so first off, you've qualified your own statement. You're kind of building up about it's conservative. Liberals play computer games like conservatives. And then I guess conservatives also play computer games like conservatives. But you talk about maybe in the term also. But I think it's, you come in whatever your personality is, and if your personality is liberal, which you're not happy with the status quo of when we're talking about liberal, lowercase l here, and you're on the left side of the political spectrum, and then of course trying to tie in like real life political spectrum into a game which is not real life. And if you're playing it like your personality, or if you're not playing it as your personality, you might be role-playing and trying something different. And, yeah, you know, when she says, you know, like, civilization is designed to be, you know, a war game, getting results from lower policy takes a tremendously long time, quote-unquote. I think it's all about what you're in the mood for. Do you want to play it as a war game, or do you want to try to go for a different victory condition? We've certainly argued on the show that the war is arguably the easiest or one of the easier ways to go about it, but to come up with these very also black and white statements about liberal and conservative, because there's also, you know, there's left of center, and then there's, you know, kind of left of that still, farther down the left, and then you've also got people who are centrists, where sometimes they're liberal and sometimes they're conservative. And sometimes in a game, maybe you're always playing as a liberal. I'm going to try things. I'm going to try and experiment things. And then later on in the game, it's, oh, crap, no, that's not going to work. I shouldn't try that. And then you go back being a little bit more conservative style. So, yeah, interesting article, interesting attempt to try to explain.
Well, I mean, I think, well, liberal and conservative mean many different things in different countries. So,
that too.
You know, I mean, sometimes the liberal party is like the more, you know, right party, or I don't know, stuff like that.
So, even right and left are backwards in other countries. So,
yes, very true. Yeah.
They are so left that they are right.
There was like a cartoon depicting a linear relationship between libertarianism and affinity for Cartesian political graphs.
There's no hump. The linear is just a straight line. So no humping.
Whatever.
So after our listeners had tuned out over the last 10 minutes, all of a sudden, wait, what?
What's this political nonsense on Polycast? This is ridiculous.
This is actually a quite old topic. It started in 2009. Mitten says that he finished a Monarch game.
That his production city went the Apostolic Palace and then the University of Sankor, and the results were ridiculous. I set you the benefits of a metagame corporation as all of my cities were getting at least +4 hammer, +4 beaker, and +2 gold as a base. So as a result, he was able to run 90 to 100% research all of the time. Further hammers were saved because all of my neighbors were friendly. He says, I never thought much about a religious economy past getting shrines or capturing profitable ones, and this can probably be done much better with other leaders. He was playing as Hatshepsut, so he mentions Swanika Pak, Ramses, Mansa Musa. And he says, is this sort of thing, so that's beelining the theocracy paper and divine right technologies, viable on higher levels? Anyone else just try this sort of thing regularly? Tips, thoughts? I will say I always considered either building a religious shrine, either because I founded a religion or I captured the religion. It's always frustrating when you get a religion from another civ and they haven't built the shrine for you yet.
Mm.
Very inconsiderate. But
that is actually quite rare, you know. You know, when an AI has a holy city that doesn't have a shrine, it actually makes all of the cities to hire priests until it gets great profit. It's extremely difficult for that to happen unless you don't have enough time, but if you're going to knock on their doors too early, basically.
Well, I played a multiplayer game as a Diplo game. I played the Arabs, and I had a specific strategy in mind, a goal of getting as many of the religions as possible. And that was the basis for basically my entire economy. I had very little in the form of defense or anything like that, but I had more money than I planned. I had 5 religions? 5 out of 7? And I had all the shrines and they just spread like wildfire, and well, basically I science running at 100%.
You got all these religions by founding them yourself, by going for those technologies,
yeah.
Right?
I beelined for religious technologies as much as I could get away with, and it really paid off in that game because no one was kind of expecting it, right? and once they saw that I had this amazing amount of money flowing in, I of course became a threat, and the war was declared and all that stuff, but, you know, I was able to buy allies practically. So it's certainly worth it, and I noticed that in the multiplayer games that I play that are not like Killfests, the ones, the gentleman's game, so to speak, right, where people, formally declare war on each other and that. In those games, religion is very powerful, because it gives a player a ridiculous amount of money, at least from the shrine, and then, of course, the Apostolic Palace gives you extra, and then once you build the Apostolic Palace, other civs will want to get your religion and spread it and build the production bonus, which will give you more money. So,
when you said that you were going for the religious technologies for as much as you could get away with it, what are you meaning by that?
I don't remember this game was years ago, but
no.
Yeah, I had to have at least a basic defense. I had to expand and get some production and stuff like that. But I could ignore things like markets and other things that were money-wise important because I had so much gold coming in. And also the bonus of it. I mean, a diplomacy game. My religious friends, right, they actually treated me nicely at first because I was the founder of their great religion and such. You have to have a basic defense. Once you have that, you can pretty much get away with just beelining for the and also you need tech. You need to make sure that you can tech to these things before other people, and you need to make sure that you can defend yourself to keep your holy cities so that others won't get tempted to take them away from you.
I think I would add to the defense and the technology that you've also played your diplomacy cards well, because you mentioned about getting some other people on your side to go do some heavy fighting on your behalf.
Yeah, well, I had the defensive alliances, defensive pacts. There you go. But, of course, you know, not actual defensive pacts, but just, you know, official or, you know, unofficial, like, if they attack you, I'll promise to support you. Really, I will.
A mutual military struggle sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because you see, to me, and then it comes up actually apart from the me and team in a way, and the thread talks about how this isn't an economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when he's talking, the person's talking about a religion economy as compared to a specialist economy or a cottage economy or the really cool espionage economy that we looked at a couple of years ago.
Ooh.
I find that I don't have a religion economy, but this is more incidental rather than purposeful, that I can get a secondary economy through shrines of religions. And that's because I've done my, here's a surprise, the domination thing, and religions, but I've captured them and they have the shrines, and now, there's some more shinies for me to be able to keep my empire from crashing, which allows me to build more units, and then let's go for, I have religion number one and two, let's go for number three. Oh, maybe I pick up number four, I miss number five, so sad, too bad, there's number six. But I've never but that would never be my economy basis. It would just be kind of a supplement. You know, like the vitamins you take in the morning.
Yeah.
Still, you just take the vitamins.
Well, I would say that there are two concepts around the topic. First is the shrines, having 11 shrines if you mod the game. And the other is to have the, he calls the religious economy by itself, that is, that having the right wonders and having the buildings of that religion, the monastery, the temple, the cathedral. The first one you can capture. The second one needs work because you can't capture temples, you can't capture monasteries and whatever.
Mm.
The second one is, I do remember a game that I have some years ago, you know, when I ran the Lonely Hearts series. That I ran Ramses and I tried religious, and I tried to do the second one. I do remember that it didn't go quite as well, just because of a reason. I chose, because the Lonely Hearts is that isolated, my religion, that the religion that I founded, didn't spread around the other continent. It was all Buddhist, of course, typical. And in the end, I ended with, from the moment they discovered me until the end of the 20th century, in war with one, when it ended one of the wars, started another, and another, and another, and another, and another, until I get the spaceship and get the hell out of there. I just say that having those buildings, it really helps when you are being pillaged and you have bombers and whatever destroying your infrastructure left to right. But in my opinion, it simply doesn't work. The work, the missionaries, especially the missionaries, and they obviously they fail a lot, especially if you have more than one religion.
CreatureBoy11 mentioned in the chat about seeing the viability of a religious economy, just building a lot of missionaries, and I am paraphrasing slightly.
Pretty much. Unless you get a religion that in the continent that no one has it, it is a lot of work. And for you don't have it, you basically you have to have a lot of AIs in there. Say Easy, Justinian, Ramses, the guys that like to found religion. Mm. If you get the continent by, for example, the Portuguese leader João and Roosevelt, you might actually pull it out. But if you put a Zaro or a Justinian in the middle of the mix, forget it. You have to go missionary path, and it is better to go down route and smash them all and whatever.
Well, Polycast is nothing if not responding to listener feedback, particularly during our live audience. So, as per request, if you are going down this path, you probably want to be singing, "That's Me in the Corner."
No.
That's me founding all religions.
That's
don't make
point.
Me have to come all the way through to Canada and give slap you upside the head.
Please don't do it.
Promises, promises, Mackie.
You won't be enjoying it.
Yes.
No.
But anyway, anything else on the religious victory, or you're all just trying to wonder what the next lyrics would be? Well, I'll write them, and I'll follow up with the next verse next week.
No, thank you.
By the Caesar, he's just asking that whether it's really, you know, really worth building cities on one tile islands. Because on Archipelago, the AI seems to do this a lot, but it doesn't really seem to be worth it because you have no hammers for the city if it's a one tile island. Of course, there are like wonders and stuff, but I guess he says to disregard them, which just a caveat, I don't know how you can do that, but yeah, they were saying, and basically he's complaining about the fact that we have to live by everything, and, you know, there's just absolutely no hammers in that city. And there was some discussion of what unique buildings would be most advantageous to having one square island. And also how useful it is for domination. So some people were talking about how, Portugal and Netherlands UVs are useful for it. Other people are saying, and Carthage too, but another person said that the Cocon costs more than the harbor, only has one trade route. But I would argue that in one tile island, it's just this trade route that's pretty important. In general, I would say, you know, I wouldn't really build a one tile island city unless it had some fish or seafood, at least.
Yeah, well, that's true for really any city. It's awkward to build one that doesn't have a food source, unless you're late in the game and you have biology farms available or something like that. But early game, it wouldn't make sense to settle one of those. But the important caveat, if you don't have any foreign trade routes, and that's because any time you settle a city off your continent, even if it's a one-tile island city, it's considered an intercontinental city, and its trade route value is instantly doubled from that. Well, I shouldn't say doubled, because it's a 100% multiplier, but it doesn't stack multiplicatively. But it will tank your trade route commerce from your own cities to your own cities, from one to two for every city. So if you don't have enough trade routes to go around, you're talking, if you have a 10-city empire on the mainland and you settle that thing off the coast, you will get 10 commerce instantly from settling at an island city. It'll be kind of a junker and worthless, though, unless it has some food source. Just like most other cities, you just won't grow on any tiles usefully in a meaningful period of time. But if you have at least one seafood, it is worth it. It's just a question of priority. Now, in terms of domination wins, it's pretty worthless just because it has so little land value. You only get the land value from the tile it's on. Having culture over water doesn't help for domination at all. So for domination, just consider it for its impact on your commerce, which can be worth it, certainly. And if you involve wonders, then yes, they're good.
Okay,
now, which wonder is best?
Well, I feel like one other caveat you could put to that rule about the culture is, sorry, about the domination win is that, you know, if the one tile island is, you know, by your enemy, or, you know, buy another ship, and it can, you know, you somehow, like, you know, culture bond it so that you can take over some tiles in the other person's landmass, then I feel that would be useful and very trollish, but I think it would be satisfying to do, especially if you can attack from that, too.
There's a rule in Civ 4, though, where your culture cannot extend beyond two tiles past the landmass that you're on, and that applies to one-tile island cities, too. You will never get more than a full fat cross out of a one-tile island city, except for the corners. So, not terribly useful for pressing culture on the mainland, unless you already have plot culture in the mainland from another source, in which case the culture extends. It's kind of a weird rule, like a really weird rule.
Well, it also matters if you're financial, too, because you get the extra gold on the water.
Yes, for the coastal tiles. Yeah, that's a plus, and certainly having one of the unique buildings mentioned is a plus, although a very important one was left out of those. Out of the ones that Lisa mentioned, probably the best, even though I hate to admit it, is the dike. Just, the dike is so overrated. It angers me to no end how overrated the dike is, but it is still a good building, and you get the production from it there, so it's worth considering. But for most of the game, the best unique building is probably the sacrificial altar.
It was the Netherlands UB.
Yeah.
Okay, I should have said the name. One other person mentioned the Aztec unique building, too.
And I would say that was probably best for most of the game. Not only is it a reduced-cost courthouse, and that'll help you with the distance these things come with, but having the whipping anger duration means you can really chain whip the city and get any infrastructure you need. And that's available at Code of Laws instead of much later in the game. You can really have most of your infrastructure in that city by the time the industrial era starts rolling around.
Yeah, I think other than the points already raised, another reason to settle a one-tile island is if you really need a particular strategic resource. I guess I suppose maybe a luxury too, but not to the same extent as, I have no oil. It's getting later in the game. It's like, can I trade for that? No, for whatever reason or reasons. So there is that. I do like in the opening post how the Caesar qualifies this about, he says, yes, I know there are wonders we're helping, but let's just suppose we have no wonders. And he smiles, and I'm glad he smiled, because I was like, yeah, that's one of the first things we're going to be thinking about, or at least to me, thinking about what wonders would actually help in terms of prioritizing when, in addition to if, I would say, also when, if you decide, yes, I am going to build it, when I am going to build it, and a number of wonders, both world and national, for that matter, were raised in this thread, and I agree with the argument from Limond about that the Great Lighthouse, that you get +2 trade routes in all coastal cities, is probably your best bet in terms of a wonder to help, generally speaking, for the desirability of a one-tile city, followed by the Colossus, +1 commerce for water tiles in all cities. The Apostolic Palace is mentioned. You're talking about the hammers. If you've got, the state, you don't have that be in the state religion, but you have the AP religion in your building, those buildings, okay. Followed by, then there's also talk about the Maui statues, Angkor Wat, and the Kremlin. Maui, +1 hammer on all water tiles in the city. And Angkor Wat and the Kremlin, like Angkor Wat, +1 hammer from priests in all cities. If it really is kind of food deficient, then you're probably not going to be run that many. And then the Kremlin is very expensive and will expire just like Angkor Wat will. So unless you have stone on top of it somewhere in your empire, I wouldn't really enter into the equation those two, at least strictly speaking from the consideration of, do I build this one tile island? And if so, when do I build it?
Well, no, the Kremlin's a valid consideration because you get the reduced cost of both brush buying and whipping there. So you could set up that city a lot more quickly and for less expense if you have the Kremlin. And Kremlin doesn't obsolete until very late in the game. You can opt to never obsolete it if you choose. Unless you're going for a space race victory, you'd never have to obsolete it. And I forget what obsolete is. Maybe it's computers or fiber optics. It's something that late in the game.
Fiber optics, it comes at communism, which is, it's not really late, but it's not.
Hey, people get that before 1000 AD sometimes. But anyway, the Kremlin's definitely a valid consideration there, and obviously Great Lighthouse is the strongest. And Maui's useful if you have stone. It's expensive if you don't. The Temple of Artemis will not benefit that city unless you build the Temple of Artemis in that city. And your odds of being able to do that in a normal game are pretty slim, because its base production is low, and it's really hard to rush wonders in any way. Yeah, and by the time you could rush a wonder, it's usually not around anymore. I wouldn't want to burn Great Engineer just on rushing a wonder off-coast if you could somehow get one in time. And it's often more worthwhile for its great people points than the trade routes, but trade routes are worth considering, too, I guess.
In talking about the building wonders of those single-tile islands, I would say if I ever came upon somebody that built the Great Wall on one of those, I'd have to slap them and
pure denial and trolling value. Although that would be one of the more comical looking Great Walls ever.
But
you want to be in the funny screenshots thread on CMC or something.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Well, some of my thoughts about it though, besides the, I mean, obviously the strategic resources are a good reason for doing it, but for me, I think another aspect that people probably don't really think about it is using it as like launching bases. And I know some people are afraid of probably using a settler just to grab an island, but sometimes those islands, especially if they're in the middle of nowhere, can become handy when you're launching an attack against somebody that's on the other side of that sea. If you're thinking that something like the World War II Pacific, you have all those islands out there in the Pacific, Midway and all that, those islands can come pretty handy and have little bases and hideaways that you can retreat to while you're launching the full campaign to take over the other side of the world.
Yeah, that's a good point. If your navy is weak, you can duck into these little island cities, and the AI can't attack you there unless it can somehow conquer your land units on the one tile island city, which is really unlikely. The AI is terrible at that. And if ever you need additional nukes, you can certainly rebase them into a city like that and load up your submarines once again. Although, keep in mind, you could just take an enemy city, move your submarines in, put the nukes there, and instantly load them onto the sub as well. So there are kind of cheesy things you can do to reload nukes anyway, but that's certainly an option as well.
I knew at least one of our topics was going to reference nukes. It's just obvious.
Well,
it's just a given.
I thought that went without saying, but hey, whatever. We got to have some nukes.
We're here to entertain as well as inform.
Yeah, I'm wondering how, you would get enough production to, ever build one of these wonders. By the way, I was just thinking about the Colossus, too, when we were thinking about wonders, if you build it there early enough. I mean, it's already coastal, and another person mentioned whipping a forge in order to get the engineer. Yeah, just to work the engineer to produce more, and then you could use that engineer to possibly build the Colossus in that one tile island.
Well, I guess you could, but wouldn't you almost even be better off to have some citizens being worked? For some hammers, which I guess was you could do that and then use those hammers towards constructing the forge, which would then give you some further base hammer production, but still.
I don't know. I mean, if you built like a one-tile island early on that had a food resource and you decided like it was like a decent city, like you could do that. You could like do Moai statues, whip a forge, work an engineer, build a Colossus. Why don't you just stick the Temple of Artemis in there too?
The Colossus would be done by an AI long before you'd finish it there. Yeah, really, those cities are junkers unless you're going to be whipping them, which they can be pretty decent. And unless you're getting trade outcomes or something else from it, I would expect to whip those cities a lot to make them worthwhile.
Whip it good.
I guess you could run cast and farm great people there, too. That's also a viable possibility. You don't really need any infrastructure to run specialists. And even one great person is pretty valuable. So if you have a decent food one-tile city, by all means, take advantage.
Yeah, and other than the Artemis wonder and the Maui statues, you don't actually have to build them in this one-tile city itself or benefit from them.
That's very true. You don't need to build a great lighthouse there. You don't need to build Colossus there or any of the others. Just Temple of Artemis, you wouldn't want to try building there, and it wouldn't be beneficial if built it anywhere else.
You wouldn't even get probably that much fail gold because you wouldn't be that far along if someone was meeting to it.
No.
It's likely, very likely, as you said.
That's usually a BC's wonder. You're not going to be building that in time. Maybe I'm really low difficulties, but that's about it.
And I just to be clear, we're talking about like a one square island. I think in the context is that in your big fat cross, that the one tile island, like the only land, is in fact the tile that you settled on. Talking about food resources, we're almost certainly talking about seafood resources. Not like it's one tile off. Like, ooh, look, there's some coastal food there. You know, like, oh, there's some coastal corn or banana or whatever.
You never know. Maybe you settled on top of a cow on that one tile island. I've never seen that, but sure.
Ooh, yes.
You get 3 food city tiles instead of just 2 food city tiles. Awesome.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. Record dates assorted 2010 and 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyrighted Civilized Communication at civcom.net.